Speakers today, we've got myself, Chantel, Matt Didier, and Michael Gifford, or Mike Gifford from our Brownfield section. And again, please press your #6 or your *6 buttons right now to mute us. And we're going to go on to slide 2. And that's just the title. We'll go to slide 3. Again, the presenters will each sort of provide a little bio of ourselves as we start presenting slides. I've been with the Brownfield program when it was a pilot program starting in 1995, primarily working with the states that I worked with. And then when the Brownfield program started, Brownfield pilot program, and a section developed, I became a part of that section. So I've been officially in the Brownfield section for almost 11 years. And looking through the list of participants for today's call, I think many of us here have worked with many through there, so we're glad to see you here on the line. Okay, let's go to slide 4. This provides an overview of the seminar today. We anticipate the seminar taking up to 1.5 hours, and we've reserved about a half an hour at the end for questions and answers. What you'll notice as we start going through the slides and the information is that there are a lot of proposals that are received each year for these grants, and it's a very competitive process. A little over a third and less than a half of all of the proposals are actually funded, and there's a later slide that kind of shows you that. You can always go to the Brownfield website, and which is linked here, and kind of see the communities that receive grants. We're going to cover the whole process, during your application, to the criteria and the sorts of things you should include in the criteria, kind of how the threshold works and the ranking criteria works. And then we'll provide some tips for hopefully helping you prepare as competitive a proposal as possible. Okay, let's go to the next slide. And that's just a photo. We have interspersed throughout the seminar slides some photos of Region 5 Brownfield projects, so you may recognize some of those. All right, we're on slide 6. And just to, you know, you can kind of read what's included here about the Brownfield mission. The Act has a preamble. The Brownfield Act has a preamble that says that the Act is to provide certain relief for small businesses from liability under the Comprehensive Environmental Response Compensation Liability Act of 1980, and to amend the Act to promote the cleanup and reuse of brownfields, to provide financial assistance for brownfield revitalization, and to enhance state response program and for other purposes. So you'll notice throughout the course of the discussion that we'll be referring to CERCLA or brownfields, because this act actually is an amendment to that law. Let's go to the next slide. The brownfield law created a definition for a brownfield site, which is different from the previous definition of a site that was used under the Superfund program, again, which is what this program is an amendment to. In general, the term brownfield site means real property, the expansion, development, or reuse of which may be complicated by the presence of potential hazardous substances, pollutants, contaminants, controlled substances, petroleum products, or is a mine-scarred land. So you can see this is a very broad definition. I think the emphasis here is on it's a real property. And one of the caveats to this, I'll say also, is that there are, by definition, certain types of sites that are excluded as a brownfield site, and that will be covered a little bit later. But in general, this has kind of really broadened the type of site that can be assessed with these funds. And it's also broadened the types of contaminants that can be assessed using these grant dollars. You'll notice petroleum is specifically included, where previously in the CERCLIS or the CERCLA definition of a site, petroleum was excluded if the site was primarily contaminated by petroleum. contaminants. Excuse me. So the law, and then this also the definition of the types of contaminants. Let's go on to slide 8. You'll see that it really does include a much wider range of contaminant types. Again, because of the brownfields definition, we're allowed under the new law to brownfields law to assess things like asbestos and lead paint inside of a structure that is intact. Before the law was passed, the CERCLA definition or the CERCLA definition of a site required basically said that it was the release of a hazardous substance to the environment and where that hazardous substance has come to be located. So it really was more capturing a contaminant. It might have been a contaminant released to the ground, got into the groundwater, and migrated off-site. And so your site kind of was wherever that contaminant came to be located. Again, the difference here is this is real property. It's not a release. So previously we could look for asbestos in the environment if, say, you had a dilapidated building and there was friable asbestos in the building. There was the potential, because the building was dilapidated, windows were broken, there was a potential for this asbestos to migrate out through the building into the environment. So you could, at that point, kind of make a case that, yes, there's a release to the environment. So we're no longer constrained to that release to the environment requirement. So it really has, again, opened up the and broadened the types of sites that can be assessed and the types of contaminants. And these are kind of the typical sorts of contaminants that we see in Region 5 being assessed. We don't have too many mine-scarred lands that have been proposed with the since the law was enacted. Probably the only other type of a different type of contaminant than is listed that we've kind of seen come up is testing for mold. And it's not that frequently included for projects, but it has been included. Okay, let's move to slide 9. One of the things that you're going to need to include in your proposals is some description of your anticipated benefits if you receive the brownfield funding. How will your community benefit from the use of the funds? So here are some examples of the sorts of things that are included in the guidelines, and you want to keep in mind when you're preparing your proposal. You need to kind of think forward a little bit to, kind of what do you expect to happen as a result of assessment or cleanup of some of the properties in your community. Okay, going on to slide 10, this just provides a general overview of the funding and the numbers of grants that have been awarded since the brownfield projects started happening. And again, initially they were pilot projects. And so this gives you kind of a general overview. For comparison, Region 5 numbers are approximately close to 600 brownfield grants being awarded for a cost or funded totally for about $235 million. Region 5's contribution to the number of properties assessed that's included here nationally is about close to 1,600 properties. Dollars leverage is about $2 billion for Region 5, and the total number of jobs generated is a little more than 6,900 jobs. So that gives you kind of a sense of perspective and how Region 5 fits into this larger program. All right, so let's jump, again, another nice picture of a project site. And let's go on to slide 12. The brownfield law authorized funding levels as described on this slide. While up to $200 million is authorized, it's never actually been awarded in any fiscal year so far. The most that's been awarded has been a little bit over $75 million. The average since the law was passed was the lowest was $70 million, around $70 million, and the highest that was awarded was about a little over $75 million. So you can kind of get a sense of the magnitude of the awards. And there's a later slide that shows a little more concrete examples for the past round of awards. In addition, $50 million is set aside for state and tribes, and that's not competitive money. It's essentially set aside state and tribes to either develop or enhance the response program. We have an unofficial limit of 50% of those awards can be used to do targeted brownfield assessments. We're going to talk about those a little bit later. Also, $200 million for the competitive awards. The law specifically requires that 25% of the awards be for petroleum contaminated sites. So you'll find as we go through the presentation that there is a distinction between the two types of projects, and you can request funds for either type. The $200 million competitive dollars are for assessment type grants, revolving loan type grants, cleanup grants, and job training grants, and some brownfield targeted assessments. We're not going to cover in too much detail the brownfield targeted assessments, although we'll talk about that a little more. It's something that would be available to you and to your community kind of on a site-by-site basis. The job training grants that were covered and are addressed under by another group of people, and actually there was yesterday an internet seminar on their current proposal guidelines. So if you're interested in that, you can always go to the Brownfield website. It's pretty easy to find information on the job training grants, and it's actually a pretty interesting program, and it could be applicable to your community. So let's move on to slide 13, and that just shows you how we came up with this acronym ARC, which you'll see interspersed in the guidelines, and it's referenced in a lot of places. And so it's basically assessment, revolving loan, and cleanup. The revolving loan funds are to be used for cleanup of sites, but it's a loan fund program, so that's the distinction. There are three different, you would prepare three separate proposals for each of these types of grants if you were interested in applying for them, and more details will be provided later. Again, we describe these as competitive grants and 104K grants. We're no longer calling any of our grants pilots because we were initially a pilot program, and upon enactment of the law, we became a brownfield program. So that is that. Let's go on to slide 14. Again, we can't emphasize enough that these are very competitive grants, so you really need to be conscious of that when you're preparing your proposal. Our next slide will show what you're up against, and maybe the wrong word, but during this last round of funding, over 845 proposals were received. So that's a lot of proposals. And your proposal that you submit this year is going to be evaluated basically against all these other proposals. So you want your proposal to be as competitive as possible so it ends up at the top of the list so you can get some funding. Out of all of these proposals, only 314 were funded at $74 million total for this recent award. This occurred in April of this year. If you look at Region 5 numbers, which are a little bit further down the slide, out of all of the proposals, Region 5 communities submitted 224 proposals, and 93 grants were funded for a total of $26 million. So this, I think, is just kind of gives you kind of a sense of perspective and kind of helps you to see that there is quite a bit of competition for these funds. We had initially anticipated the proposal guidelines to be announced in early August. At this point, we're not sure exactly when it will be. However, it appears as though there will be a 90-day lag between when the announcement is made and when proposals are due. This slide, I think when we modified it, we have that spring 2009 sort of stuck in there, and that actually should have been on a separate line as the anticipated award time frame. So spring 2009 is tentatively kind of when we would anticipate making awards for these proposals that will be due sometime October, November-ish. And the anticipated funding level will be about $72 million nationwide. At the end of this seminar, we didn't include the link, but we'll tell you the link, and it's very easy to find. If you want to be notified when the RFPs are announced, you can sign up to EPA's listserv and then get a notification of any kind of relevant brownfield information, and the proposal announcement will be part of that. So that will help. But I would recommend, let's go to the next slide, 17. I'd recommend that if you are interested in applying for these funds, that you go on to these links or through the Brownfields website. It's very easy to find, even if you just go to the EPA Brownfields website. You don't have to use these direct links. They're right out there. These are, again, draft guidelines. They're not finalized yet. However, it's not anticipated that there will be major changes to them. I would highly recommend, I think everybody here would probably recommend that you read the guidelines really carefully. Again, they're significantly different from past years. Up until now, the format has been so similar that if, as an example, you prepared a proposal for 1 year, a lot of times you could almost prepare new cover letters and submit almost the identical proposal in subsequent years. Well, that cannot happen in this next round. So I do recommend that you get familiar with the guidelines, read them, and then when the final guidelines come out, download them, print them off, or just read them, read them again and kind of see. Again, the more you read them, the more familiar you'll be with the requirements. A lot of the information that's being requested is the same. It's just in different places, and we're going to go into a lot more detail on that in subsequent slides. Okay, let's move on to slide 18. Some of the changes that occurred with this newest round and the proposal guidelines are identified here. For the assessment grants, which are used to do phase one, phase two characterizations of sites, you could potentially prepare remedial action plans. You should also conduct community involvement activities. You can do inventory of brownfield sites and some prior, and maybe even create a prioritization scheme after you inventory your sites. You can apply community-wide, so your proposal wouldn't identify specific sites that you would anticipate assessing. You can apply for a single site or a site-specific assessment grant, and you can also apply this year as a coalition. And this is the first year you can do the coalition application. You've always been able to apply for up to $200,000 in hazardous substance funding and or $200,000 for petroleum funding. One major change this year is that you can now submit one proposal that includes the information for your request, basically, your proposal for both the $200,000 in hazardous substance dollars and $200,000 for petroleum contaminated sites. So historically, you would have to have prepared two separate proposals, and this year you can combine them into one. The next slide goes over kind of the site-specific assessment criteria. Or proposal criteria, you can, again, apply for up to $200,000 for one site, and that's a total of $200,000, whether the contamination is petroleum or hazardous substances or if it's both. Our general limit for expenditures of the brownfield grant funds is $200 per site. You can request a waiver through the site-specific grant proposal for the expenditures of up to $350,000 per property. EPA would have to approve that waiver. You can only apply for one site-specific grant for your community, per eligible entity, so that would be for your community. You would need to provide all of the information that's requested regarding the site eligibility and property ownership. That's a threshold requirement. For the community-wide proposals, the site eligibility and property ownership information isn't provided up front, but if you do get awarded a grant, you will need to go back to that criteria and provide that on a site-by-site basis to your project coordinator as sites come forward for a phase one or a phase two, and so you'll work with your project coordinator in determining eligibility of sites at that point. For the assessment coalition, slide 20. You could apply for up to $1 million in hazardous substance and or petroleum funds. It's $500,000 of each type of fund. An assessment coalition is defined as three or more eligible entities. Because there is a maximum expenditure per site of $200,000 per site, if you're going to request $1 million, you would need to include the assessment of at least five sites. Coalition members cannot apply for any of the other types of assessment grants if they're part of a coalition. So if you're not part of a coalition, you could apply for $200,000 in petroleum money, $200,000 in hazardous substance money, and you could apply for one site-specific assessment grant. But if you are part of a coalition, you could not apply for those other types of grants this year. In subsequent years, you could. And if you're currently a grantee, if you have previous grants, you can still this year apply as part of a coalition. It's just the restriction is for this year. So you can't do them two times. Yep.
This is Matt. Hi. As a tag notes up there, this is a new feature this year. The work group that did all these revisions to the guidelines this year talked about this and came up with this as a suggestion change, and we decided to try it. The original intent of it was to help generally smaller communities who may not have a need for an entire $200,000, maybe don't have the administrative capacity to deal with a grant on their own. So the idea was by banding some of these together, probably with the participation of a larger, more savvy, more capable, larger organization, that it would be a way to get money to some of these smaller communities that have had trouble in the past either getting money or have had trouble administering it once they did get money. Which is not to say that only small entities are going to be considered when we review these assessments, but that is the idea where this came from. Really important to think about is that if you're an organization that wants to be a member of a coalition, this is the only assessment grant that you're going to be able to apply for this year. Can't be part of a coalition and submit your own application. And if that happens, we're going to call you up and say, pick one. What else did I want to say about this? So that's, I think, you know, something that you're going to have to take into mind in looking at this. Seems like there was one more other thing that I wanted to say about it, but I can't remember what it is right now. So, you know, we'll talk about this more as we get along. But, you know, this is new. It may not be for everybody. Oh, the other thing I was going to say is, while there will be members of a coalition, only one of the coalition applicants is actually going to be the grantee, and they will handle all the administrative aspects of the grant. They will do the contracting, they will draw the funds, they will be responsible for the quarterly reporting. They will, of course, receive assistance from and will need to be in communication with the other members of the coalition to do this, but money is only going to go to one applicant. We're not going to make, as part of this, if we have three members of a coalition, we're not making three different awards, one to each coalition member. And as these coalitions are awarded, at the time of not during the time of the proposal, but later down the road when we get ready to award the money, the coalition members are going to have to provide us with the memorandum of agreement, memorandum of understanding that specifies how they're going to carry this project out, how they're going to decide which sites to assess, you know, how much money is going to go to each coalition member, but they're going to have to tell us how they're going to manage this thing when they get the money.
Okay, great. And there is a fact sheet that we are providing a link to at the end of the presentation, which provides a little more details on these coalitions. Okay, next slide is just an example of an assessment story, or of an assessment success story from the city of Indianapolis. I think that's kind of a straightforward one. And with this, I'm going to turn this over to Mike Gifford to start with slide 22.
Hi, I'm Mike Gifford. I've noticed on the attendance list, many of you I know, and I'm going to talk a little bit about the revolving loan fund. This is the next five slides, and talk briefly about the program, and I'll be talking a little later about site ownership and property ownership eligibility issues. The purpose of the revolving loan fund is to make loans to carry out cleanup activities, and also an eligible activity for the RLF program is to purchase environmental insurance at eligible brownfield sites. Each eligible entity can apply for up to $1 million. Coalitions have always been part of our program and continue to be part of the program under the new proposal guidelines, and coalitions of more than one eligible entity can apply for up to $1 million for each coalition member. So, for example, if a county wanted to partner with a couple of the larger, say two larger municipalities within its county, the county could come in as the applicant. The coalition members might be two communities within that county, and they could apply for up to $3 million. Most of the region's five states are managing fairly large RLF coalition grants. With an award, a minimum of 60% of the dollars that are awarded have to be used for loans. There are no limits on the dollar amount for an individual loan. A maximum of 40% of an award can be used for cleanup grants. So, for example, if $1 million is awarded to an entity, they can use up to $400,000 to award cleanup grants, recognizing that there is the statutory limit of $200,000 per site for cleanup grants. There is a cost share requirement of 20% for all revolving loan fund grant awards, and nonprofit organizations are not eligible to apply. I included slides 23 to 26. I'm not going to discuss them in any detail other than to demonstrate the range of potential applicants and grantees. Monroe, Michigan is a community of less than $25,000. That has received multiple RLF awards and is running a very successful program. The Fond du Lac, Wisconsin example is a loan that was through the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, which is currently managing about $5.5 million on behalf of its coalition members. And the point I'm trying to make here is that an individual community can submit an RLF proposal that can compete with larger cities or coalition proposals that are requesting multiple millions of dollars. So I think we'll move on to slide 27.
Okay, please mute your phone, whoever's talking. Thank you.
Actually, and 27 is an example of a, well, I'll talk about 26 briefly, the cleanup grant program, I'm sorry. The cleanup grant program is, we can award individual cleanup grants at eligible brownfield sites, and the award can be up to $200,000 per property. It is up to the applicant to define the site for which they are seeking cleanup funds. And so you will define that site in your application and will be held to that definition of that site throughout the performance of the cleanup. The application can be for hazardous substances or petroleum contamination, and you can seek both. But you must submit one proposal which cannot exceed $200,000. So there may be sites out there, and I have been involved with sites where there are distinct areas on the site where you have petroleum-only contamination, you have hazardous substance contamination. Under that scenario, you can submit a proposal where you are requesting a combination of the funds. For the cleanup grant program, nonprofits are eligible to apply for cleanup grants. Again, there is a cost share requirement of 20%. And what is new this year is the community notification, which is part of the threshold criteria, which Matt will be discussing a little later.
All right. So we're going on to slide 28. And I just want to briefly, mention these links. I had mentioned the Targeted Brownfield Assessment Program. You can go to either of these two links, the national link for the Brownfields website or to the Region 5 link. These would be assessment funds that would be available. Actually, it would be assessment assistance that either our states or EPA could provide to communities. If, as an example, you have a property that needs to be assessed, you apply for a grant, you don't get the grant, the assessment grant, you can come in and we can work with you to determine if the site is eligible for an assessment, and we can expend up to $50,000 per site. Four of our states in Region 5 have funds that are allocated to do assessments. Those are Illinois, Ohio, Minnesota, and Michigan. And so we would work with them initially to see if they would want to work with you to do the assessment or whether we would work with you from our regional EPA office and have our contractor provide the assessment. So I just want to highlight that and let you know that that service is available. Okay, can people please mute their phones?
Okay, let's go.
Okay.
We're going to go on now to discussing what needs to be specifically in your application if you're choosing to apply for one of these. Our grant application process works essentially in two stages. The first stage is the applicant providing information about themselves and, if appropriate, about the site that they're going to be working on. We will use that information to determine if the applicant and the site are eligible. If either one is not eligible, that ends the process right there. We're not going to go ahead and score and rank these things. So this is what we're going to look at. And again, this is sort of what I just said. You know, go ahead and skip to the next one.
Okay. All right, we're going to slide 31.
What you're going to need to show us is that you are an eligible entity, an eligible applicant. Everybody's going to need a letter from their state or tribal environmental authority saying that they know you're applying for a project. There's some specific question about site eligibility and property ownership, and that's going to come into play for cleanup grants and for any site-specific assessment grant that you apply for. You're going to be asked about cost share if you're applying for an RLF or a cleanup. The legal authority that you have if you're managing an RLF. The description of your jurisdiction, again, if you're an RLF. What cleanup authority and oversight structure you plan to use if you're applying for a cleanup or RLF grant. And your community notification process if you're applying for a cleanup grant. Next one, applicant eligibility. Each applicant for each grant type is going to have to explain how they fit into one of the eligible entities that our law allows us to make grants to. It falls into three categories. General purpose units of local government. Those are things like cities, counties, townships, obviously. There's some less obvious ones, things like park districts, school districts, housing authorities, these are also things that we consider to be general purpose units of local governments. States and tribes are eligible. And then we also allow funding to what we're describing as quasi-governmental entities, which is really part of a subset of this general purpose unit of local governments. These are things that we often see in, like, regional planning commissions, economic development authorities, those kind of things. Generally, we need a little bit more information on these to determine if they're eligible. We'll often need to look at the enabling legislation or resolution that the board of these institutions or these organizations passed to establish them. But, you know, we have a lot of eligible entities. And those entities that I just described can receive cleanup, RLF, or assessment grants. Our eligibility also allows us to make grants to nonprofit organizations, but only for cleanup grants. And to show us that you're a nonprofit organization, in the past we've just needed a letter from the IRS identifying you as a 501c3 organization. Let's skip on to coalition applicants. This is, again, part of the threshold requirement. And I was talking a little bit about coalition applicants earlier. Again, if you want to try to do this, you need three or more members for assessment, only two for RLF. The difference here being how the money amount would total up to for the different kinds of applicants. So it wouldn't really make sense to have any more than have only two assessment RLF applicants because each one of them could apply for $400,000, you know, $800,000 total, which is less than they'd be able to apply for up as part of a coalition. So from a monetary standpoint, it doesn't really make sense for anybody to go into a coalition unless there's three organizations. All members of a coalition must be separate legal entities. So, you know, a county road department, Department of Public Works, and Economic Development Department together are not going to be a coalition. They need to be separate legal entities. For example, three counties or three cities or a county and two cities, things like that. If you want to do this, in the proposal you're going to have to show that all the members, each member is an eligible entity on its own, and the coalition members are going to have to provide a letter just saying that they're willing to be part of the coalition. It doesn't have to be a great level of detail at this point. That would come later on if this application is selected for funding. Then we're going to get into specifics about how the coalition applicants are going to get along together. This one, we're just saying, you know, let us know that you're aware that someone is making you part of a coalition. Next one. Site ownership, and this is only for our cleanup grants. If you want to have a cleanup grant, you don't have to own that site at the time you apply for the grant. You will, however, have to own that site before you get any award, before you actually get any money, and at the latest by June 30th of 2009. And I want to take a little break here. I think this slide tends to understate the importance of this consideration. In a world where we often don't have really hard deadlines or really hard requirements that we can't figure out a way to work around, this is one that is a hard deadline and a requirement that we will not work around. This year alone, we've had five cleanup applications that we selected to receive money who won't be getting money because they did not get ownership by this date. We've defined ownership as fee simple title. So that means a purchase option on a site is not going to satisfy ownership. Some kind of legal agreement with the actual title holder to get access to the site is not going to satisfy the ownership requirement. And ownership by some kind of partner organization, for example, a economic development agency or a limited liability corporation that's associated with the applicant, that's not going to satisfy our ownership definition. The people applying for the money, the people getting the money, have to own the site during the term of cleanup. As soon as cleanup's done, you can dispose of it however you may wish. Just another warning on this. If you're not, applicants who are not really sure that they can meet this requirement are probably best to hold their powder for a subsequent round of applications. We do, as part of the review process, assess an applicant's ability to manage a grant. If we have grants from applicants who in previous years have not been able to get ownership of a site, that's not going to reflect well on their ability to manage these grants if they are selected to receive one. Last one here that applies to general things rather than sites is a letter from your state environmental or tribal authority. The states and tribes themselves, if they're applying for an application, for example, if Michigan wants money, they don't have to get themselves their own letter. But, you know, any local governments, any of these other eligible entities, including the not-for-profit organizations, if they're going to submit an application, we need in the package a letter from the state saying, yeah, we know this applicant is applying for money. If you're applying for multiple grant types, we only need one letter. And, you know, be fair to your state. Give them enough time to write these letters. Generally, I think it's pretty easy to find out who to address these requests to, either by checking your state's brownfield section of their website or giving them a call. Real quick, I don't know if we address it anywhere else in this presentation, but any one applicant is permitted to apply for assessment grants totaling $400,000, that being $200,000 for HAZ, $200,000 for Petro, an RLF grant up to $1 million, and three cleanup grants, $200,000 each. So any one applicant can apply for up to, what does that add to, $2.2 million.
Okay.
Roll to the next slide.
All right. Slide 36, and Mike Gifford.
Well, in addition to my last 12 years being in brownfields, I spent the previous 11 years for better or for worse in Superfund. So I'm going to talk a little bit about site and property ownership eligibility. The first bullet talks about their note that the brownfield law prohibits EPA from providing grant funds to an entity that is considered potentially liable under CERCLA, which is generally referred to as the Superfund law. And the basis for this is since the brownfield law is an amendment to CERCLA, the liability provisions of Superfund must be applied in determining the eligibility of each brownfield site. And terms that you may have heard in the past or may hear are joint, strict, and several. And that's the liability scheme of CERCLA, and joint being that you do not have to have caused the contamination to be liable. And strict and several is if you've got multiple causers of contamination in the site, any individual causer is liable for the full cost of the cleanup. So really the critical part here is that the last two bullets, that the liability for site owners and site eligibility are highly dependent on how and when the site was acquired. Next slide, please. Okay. Sites that are not eligible, and there are three, those that are on the national priority list or proposed for listing, properties that are under administrative orders, court orders, or other decrees, and properties subject to jurisdiction or control of the U.S. government. These sites will never be eligible. By statute, these sites are ineligible. Next slide, please. With respect to hazardous substance sites, petroleum sites, for hazardous substance sites, remember when you, for site-specific assessment and cleanup applicants, EPA is the decision maker. Since this is a threshold criteria, EPA will be making the determination as to whether or not the site is eligible and whether or not the application is eligible, and will move on to the national panel for review. However, being a threshold criteria, this is something that we can talk with you about up front, because the last thing we want to see happen are applicants submitting proposals for sites that are not eligible. So there is the opportunity to discuss this ahead of time regarding the eligibility of the site and regarding the eligibility of the applicant. Next slide regarding ownership eligibility. Now, this slide applies to all cleanup grant applications, and site-specific assessment proposals, where the applicant owns the site or plans to acquire the site during the term of the grant. And as Matt mentioned earlier, for a cleanup grant, you will have to have acquired title by June 30th of 2009. Common liability exemptions or defenses include involuntary, bona fide prospective purchaser, and I'm an innocent landowner or contiguous property owner, and I'm really not going to discuss either of those in any significant detail, as these defenses are generally hard to make. The only thing I will say for both of these defenses is that the purchaser must not have had knowledge of the contamination at the time of the purchase of the property, even after conducting appropriate inquiry. Next slide, please.
We're on slide 40.
Which is, let's move on to 41. It basically restates what 40 is.
Okay, slide 41.
Now, the bona fide prospective purchaser provision is a post-Brownfield law defense to CERCLA liability. It is not retroactive. So you cannot be a bona fide prospective purchaser if you acquired property prior to January of 2002 when the Brownfield law was passed. As a bona fide prospective purchaser, you cannot be responsible for the contamination, either as an owner, an operator, a generator, or a transporter, nor can you have any affiliation with the responsible party. And generally, this might be by contractual or familial relationship. And there are other continuing obligations that you need to undertake to maintain your bona fide prospective purchaser defense. Now, one thing that the law, there was an amendment to the law or a change that was made that, as I mentioned, bona fide prospective purchaser is not retroactive. However, if an owner of a site meets all the elements of a bona fide prospective purchaser with the exception of the acquisition date, in other words, the property was acquired prior to January of 2002, you may be eligible for a grant. What you will need to demonstrate is that the appropriate inquiry that you conducted at the time of purchase was the accepted practice at the time, and recognize inquiry in 2000 is going to be much different than what was customary in 1980 as part of a property transaction. Move on to the next slide, please. So what would determine ownership eligibility or site eligibility is when the site was acquired, and here's a listing of the ASTM standards, and again the dates for which they would be applicable for the purchase of the property. And that last bullet again touches on what I talked about a little earlier about if you acquired property prior to the passage of the law, and this is especially before 1997, where it's going to be case specific. It's going to be based on information about the site that was known, again, what was usual and customary at that time when the property was purchased. And that, again, this is where we can work with an applicant and talk with an applicant up front to ensure that a site is eligible, or at least get a feel that the site is eligible before the application is submitted.
Okay, we're on slide 43.
Slide 43. And there's a critical admission in this first bullet. And if you look at the proposal guidelines, you'll see a lot of references to the ASTM standard and all appropriate inquiry. But one key phrase here, and it's an admission from the first bullet, is it talks about requiring an AAI compliant phase one. Following phase one, it should be or equivalent. And the or equivalent clause accounts for petroleum sites in which they're not, CERCLA doesn't apply to petroleum sites. And it also applies to instances where there may not have been a ASTM phase two completed. There may have been another site investigation report or a remedial action plan. But the bottom line is there needs to be some equivalency to either the phase one or the phase two for applicants that are submitting proposals for plant grants. For petroleum sites that are not owned by tribes, the applicants must submit information to the state, and the state will make the eligibility determination. And listed here are the criteria that are in the proposal guidelines and will serve as the basis upon which the state will make their determinations.
Okay. Going on to slide 45.
For both cleanup and RLF applicants, what you need also include, and these are threshold criteria, is describe how you will oversee the cleanup of the site and whether you plan to enroll the site in a state or tribal voluntary response or cleanup program. If you are not planning to do that, then you will need to discuss how you will ensure that any cleanups that are conducted are protected. For cleanup only, you must provide your plan to obtain access to adjacent or neighboring properties if necessary. And there also needs to be, for RLF applications, a legal opinion. In the past, there were generally two letters that were required. It can now be incorporated into one letter that documents that you, as the applicant, have the legal authority to access the secure site. You have the authority to manage a revolving loan fund. In other words, hold funds, make loans, enter the loan agreements, collect repayments, and so forth.
Now, for these questions about site eligibility are really only going to have to be answered at the time of application for cleanup grants and if you apply for a site-specific assessment grant. If you apply for an RLF or a community-wide assessment grant, you will eventually have to address these things, but it won't be until after you receive the money and you pick a specific site to work on.
And one other thing I will add, for the site-specific proposals, it's not absolutely necessary that you own the site. You may or may not own the site, but if you do not own the site, you will still have to affirm that you, as the applicant, are not a potentially liable party.
That's for a site-specific assessment grant, not for a cleanup grant. Cleanup grant, you got to own it.
Right, cleanup grant, you got to own it.
Seems like there's one other thing. Oh, you know, Mike did a really good job of explaining these things. They are inherently complex and confusing, and we are always happy to entertain questions about eligibility of a specific site. I think that's the best way for you to provide yourself with some level of comfort that, you know, you're not wasting your time preparing an application. Call one of us. If you know somebody else here in the Brownfield section, call them. talk about the site, we'll be able to give you a good idea of whether that site's going to be eligible or not.
We also have several attorneys that work very closely with our program and are available to talk about site eligibility and applicant eligibility issues as well. So by all means, if any questions come up regarding the eligibility of specific sites, give us a call.
Okay, even if you're sure it's eligible, call somebody here. It just wastes everybody's time if we end up with an application for a site that turns out not to be eligible.
Okay, slide 46, cost share. Matt and I have both touched on this a little earlier, that both cleanup and RLF grant recipients are required to provide a 20% cost share. For example, for $1 million RLF award, the cost share required is 20%. What you have to indicate in your application is a plan for how that cost share will be satisfied. You're not going to be held to that, but there are a variety of ways that the cost share can be satisfied, and since especially for a revolving loan fund, you may not yet know what sites are potentially going to be used, or potential sites are going to be cleaned up, and oftentimes the cost share can be passed on to the developer. There may be other local or state dollars that are available, that are being made available for the site that can satisfy the cost share. The bottom line is provide a plan as to how the cost share will be satisfied. For the cleanup, you need to be a little more definitive because it is a site-specific proposal.
One thing to know is there are lots of ways to come up with your match, whether it be cash, whether it be in-kind contribution of staff time, whether it be the provision of, some equipment through the local government that has a cleanup grant. You don't have to have, if you're applying for a cleanup grant, you don't have to have $40,000 sitting in a bank account somewhere waiting to spend on this application. Even if you would decide to use cash as your match, you can provide that as you draw money out of the grant. So, the cost share obviously is a consideration, but I don't think it has to necessarily be as daunting as some people sometimes view it. Last one. Community notification. There is a difference, pretty big difference this year, and how the guidelines handle community notification, which is simply, the applicant making their community aware that they're applying for this grant. In previous years, in the last couple of years, it's been a scoring criterion, and it is applied to all the grant types. This year, it's a threshold criteria. It makes much more sense in that part of the application, and it only applies to the cleanup grant. So if you're applying for a assessment or RLF application, you don't have to worry about doing this. If you're applying for a cleanup grant, you're going to have to let the community know what your project is, and you do that by placing an ad in a local newspaper or some equivalent notification. We've generally decided that a notice on your local government website or your departmental website is sufficient notice. And that needs to go out at least 2 weeks prior to the date of submittal. It's probably going to actually should be a little bit more than that, because what you are noticing, what you're telling people is there, is a completed copy of your grant proposal, which people are allowed to see. So this notice needs to tell applicants, we have this proposal, we're applying for this grant, you can get a copy of the proposal at this location, whether it's been hard copies have been placed in City Hall, local libraries, whether you can access it through a PDF file or some kind of file off your website. But you need to know, let people know how they can get a copy of this thing to read, and you need to let them know, you need to let them know how they can make comments, if they wish, on that proposal.
We're on slide 48 now.
Yeah, we're on slide 48. They need to know where and to whom and when to make any comments they want, and you need to let them know when you're going to have a public meeting on this thing. You don't necessarily have to have a separate public meeting. If you want to do it as part of a regular board meeting for your town, that's fine. You just need to, mention that in your ad or your web posting talking about the application. If you're planning for 3 cleanup grant sites, you can have 1 meeting. However, you have to have all 3 applications available for people to read.
Okay, next slide, 49. Okay, so don't that. All right, we're moving on to slide 50, and now 51, the ranking criteria.
Yep. All right, so assuming you make it through this threshold criteria section, and chances are that you're going to, we had 224 applications this year. We may have had 4 that were ineligible. So we ask for a lot of information. Everybody generally makes it. For the threshold criteria, if you provide a wrong answer to anything, we will call you and try to get a clarification on your response in order to try to get the application to pass threshold criteria. Consequently, we don't lose very many of these things. The ones that we do lose tend to be cleanup applications based on site eligibility. After you pass threshold, then all the applications will be scored and ranked and compared to each other to see which ones are going to receive money. And the way this works is we end up with a rank order list for each grant type, and we go down the list allocating money to them until we're out of money. The ranking criteria, and this is where the big changes are between this year's guidelines and previous year's guidelines. And anybody who's done one before is going to, I think, really quickly see these differences. We have now 4 sections in our scoring criteria. And so you'll know when we get these in, when we decide they are eligible, they go into a national pool to be distributed for review. Anything that comes in from Region 5, we won't score. It'll go to other regions to be scored. So we got 4 sections, as you can see there, that the ranking criteria is going to consist of.
Slide 52.
Each criteria has some number of sub-criteria. If you've done this in previous years, I think you'll be happy to notice that we have not only fewer criteria, but fewer sub-criteria. That said, make sure you answer each sub-criteria individually. They may be the same or different depending on grant type, so the sub-criteria may be different for, and will be different for, assessment and cleanup. They may also vary in their scoring between the different grant types, but the total for all the different grant types is going to be 100.
Slide 53.
Community need. This is going to be the first section that you're going to write about. We're going to be looking for you to describe the need of the applicant and their residents regarding their health, welfare, and environmental concerns, and also financial needs of the applicant, organization, and their residents.
554.
Health, welfare, and environment. We're going to be looking for information on the size of your target community. What your target community is up to you to decide. For a community, for a community-wide assessment application, you may want to make your entire legal jurisdiction your targeted community. You may want to make one or two neighborhoods your targeted community where you're planning to do assessments. Use information relevant to that target community, however you want to define it, as your baseline. So we're going to want to know some general information about the size of that target community, sort of what it's made up of. Is it residential? Is it mixed use? Is it heavily industrial? And what kinds of environmental issues do you expect to encounter in that target community? We're going to ask about sensitive populations within that targeted community. This is a statutory ranking factor and one that we're required to ask about. Some applicants, I think, sometimes get sensitive about, are very aware of having to do demographic breakdowns of people that they're dealing with. This is something that we have to consider by statute. And then what we call here disproportional environmental impact. What we really want to know is if there are health effects that are particular to this targeted community. One thing that we see commonly are rates of asthma, rates of cancer, rates of other possible chronic diseases that are, more prevalent in this target community than they are in the remainder of your jurisdiction or in surrounding jurisdictions.
Slide 55.
The other part of community need is financial need. So this is where we talk about money. What is the, in addition to what's the health situation of residents in your targeted area, what's their financial level of need? In looking at that and trying to make an assessment of that, we look for our applicants to provide information that's pretty widely, generally available on things that'll tell us about, the status of this community's residents. Things like rates of poverty, household income, unemployment rates. Other things that we often see are, percentage of children in school lunch or breakfast programs, rates of poverty here. Use current data sources. A lot of times this stuff can be had from Census Bureau and Department of Labor documents or publications or websites. Table format would be great. It's helpful, I think, to compare this information to state or particularly national data. This is a national competition, and so, it helps to be able to compare this to other applicants from around the country, not necessarily just applicants from, you know, the local area. You know, what is financial need for a community relative to its, you know, other suburban neighbors is not the same as what community need for one town, perhaps compared to another town of similar size, similar makeup, somewhere else in the country. Okay. There's a thing there that says discuss impact of closed factories, you know, number of jobs lost, property tax impacts, etc. I think you can extend beyond that. If your targeted area is not an industrialized one, if it's residential or mixed use, you know, go beyond just industrial considerations to tell us about other problems that may occur in this targeted area, loss of affordable housing or lack of affordable housing, lack of open space, anything that your project is trying to address, you know, point out why this community is lacking that or in need of it, whether it's, you know, industrial development or commercial development or whatever it may be. And then finally, we want to know something about financial need of the applicant, apart from the residents of the targeted community. So we'd like to know about the fiscal condition, perhaps the tax base, population size of the entity that's applying. So if you're a local government, we want to know about your finances. In all these things, please identify where you're getting your information from. Next slide. Project description and feasibility of success. This is a new section that we've added. The other ones are similar to what we've done before. This section, we want you to tell us in your own words, in broad terms as you want to make them, what your brownfield project is. If you're doing assessments, explain how doing assessments figures into your community's general brownfield plan, and if appropriate, its overall economic development plan. If you're talking about a cleanup proposal, you know, tell us about this site and what it means to its surrounding community, what your goals for its eventual redevelopment are, how that fits into your broader brownfield goals and plans. You know, we've never really given applicants an opportunity to write, you know, what they think their brownfield project or program is. And, you know, this is your chance to do it. This is your chance to make an impression on your scores about how well thought out not only this specific application, but your broader brownfield goals and plans are. So I'd say take advantage of it.
Slide 57.
Feasibility of success. We want to know, you know, how likely are you to be able to pull off these plans? We'd like to know specifically, and I think this is really important for cleanup projects, we want to know what your proposed cleanup plan is. Are you going to involve institutional engineering controls in that plan? And for everything, what's your site reuse plan? What do you want this thing to be when it grows up? Next slide.
Okay.
Similar things for RLF. You know,
I'll talk about this a little bit real briefly. And, I mean, Matt did a very good job of summarizing for the assessment and cleanup. And, again, this is an opportunity in your own words to describe your program, and you look at the bullets in this particular slide, and it's saying, you tell us about how you will set up and implement your program. What reviewers will be looking for is a demonstration that the applicant is ready for an RLF grant, and there is a strong likelihood of near-term success in making loans and sub-grants. Do you have a program in place? How will our dollars augment that program? Maybe you've done some pre-proposal marketing and are able to demonstrate that there is a need for these funds to provide gap financing. So again, this is an opportunity in your own words to describe your program and do it in the context of the bullets in the slide.
Okay, I'm going to try to speed up a little bit too. We want to make sure we leave enough time for questions. So I'm going to try to just hit real highlights in these slides. The budget table looks pretty much like it has in previous years. Again, we want you to describe your budget, break it down into tasks. For example, phase ones, phase twos, if you're doing cleanups, soil removal, installation of an engineered barrier. Things to watch out for that we look for when we're doing this is sort of reasonableness of the cost. We have a general idea of what we think a phase one should cost. We have a general idea of, you know, what particular types of cleanup activities can be expected. We'll look at that. Know what kind of costs are eligible and not. This is, again, particularly valuable for cleanups. There are some things that we absolutely know are not eligible. For example, purchasing property you can't spend our money on. Demolishing a building just for the sake of clearing the site, apart from any necessary cleanup, is not eligible. If we see those things in your budget, that's really going to hurt your application. Eligible expenses are another thing where you can ask us. So give us a call. If you have any questions about whether something you're looking to spend money on is an eligible activity, give us a ring. Equipment costs is sometimes confusing. Equipment is only equipment, by our definition, if it's going to cost more than $5,000 and last more than a year. So if you think you're going to need to get some computers or something to do this, that's not equipment. Supplies. There's an example of the budget table next couple pages.
One thing on the budget table that you should note is that for the RLF, you need to do a separate budget table for the dollars that you would use for subgrants and a separate table for the dollars that you would plan to use for loans. Just want to point that out.
And the only thing I will add with respect to the RLF budget, it does not have to be overly complex, again, because this is a community-wide proposal and specific sites have not been identified. And some typical tasks might be program preparation, outreach marketing, community involvement, and cleanup oversight. Those are some typical tasks you might see in a budget.
The other thing is, if you're applying for a community-wide assessment, one for hazardous and one for petroleum, you're going to do one of these budgets for each. So you'll have one application, but you'll have two budgets in it. We're still in project description, feasibility of success. So you're going to tell us something about your overall program, and you're going to give us a budget. If there are financial gaps between what your project envisions and the money you're asking us to provide you, then you want to describe here how you're going to make up that difference, what sources you're going to look for money from, what types of money it is, how, you know, an idea for us how likely you are to be able to secure those types of funding. It's really just a summary of, you know, between these three subsections, here's what we want to do, here's what we're asking you to provide us, here's how we're going to make up the balance between those two numbers.
We're on slide 65.
Programmatic capability. We're going to ask you to describe how able you are as an entity to manage this grant, should we make one. This is the only section in the scoring criteria where the home region, where Region 5, will provide a score for applicants from Region 5. There's two different sections, depending on whether you've had a grant before or not. Big things we look at, if you've had a grant before, is are you up to date on your reporting, and have you been spending money in an expeditious manner for your previous grants.
Next slide,
programmatic capability. The second thing there, calls for in-house or plan for expertise acquisition. So this is us asking you to tell us, you know, what do you have in-house and what are you going to secure in order to manage this grant? It's fine for people to say they're going to rely on a contractor to provide some of this expertise. In fact, in most places, it's going to be necessary. It is a mistake, however, to specify any particular contractor, to say that contractor X is going to do these things for us. From our perspective, no grantee has a contractor until they have gone through a competitive process to award money that we make available under a grant. So from our view, at the point of application, no one has a contractor. And our view will be that if you're telling us you have a contractor, you don't understand our acquisition regulations, and that is a problem.
Slide 67.
Community engagement and partnerships. This is, again, a little bit, we've had factors like this in previous years. It's a bit different in the way we're asking you to present it this year. We're asking you to describe all the community-based organizations that are going to be involved with you in carrying out these grant-funded activities. Community-based organizations are community-based. They're not departments of your local government. They're not the fire department. They're not the Department of Economic Development. They're not the mayor's office.
Slide 68.
You know, tell us how you're going to involve them in these specific items. Selection of a site to work on, cleanup planning, site reuse planning. If you're coming in for a cleanup grant, where you've already specified a site, let us know how you have involved the community up until that point in picking the site. If it's a community-wide thing, tell us how you're going to use them. There's some other things. The big difference this year is for every community organization that you identify as being involved, we want you and the application to describe what they're going to do, and then we're going to want a letter of support from each of these applicants acknowledging that they're participating in this project and this is how they intend to be involved. So if you're saying, you know, the local Friends of the Park is going to be involved, we're going to want to see a letter from the local Friends of the Park. For everyone that you involve, we want to see a letter. Letters that are specific to the participation of each applicant are going to be better than, you know, five letters from different organizations that all say, you know, they heartily endorse this product or event, that all say the same thing. There you go.
Slide 70. We're now going to slide 71.
Project benefits, you know, this is where you tell us if you get our money and get to do this project, how it is going to make improvements in the condition of your community. And I think the best response here is going to be things that are related to the needs that you identified in your community needs section. So if in the community needs section you tell us that, hey, in this targeted community, we need some commercial development, we need a supermarket, then your project benefits really need to address how you're going to get a supermarket or some other kind of commercial enterprise in there. If you need affordable housing, and you're talking about that in your community needs section, your benefit that you're coming out with really should be an expansion of affordable housing.
Next slide.
This is just, again, a little bit more detail about what I talked about.
Slide 73.
Economic benefits and green space. In the past, these have kind of been separate sections in the in the application, and I think people felt like they had to describe a project that had economic development and green space in order to maximize their point value. I think this year we're trying to make it clear that projects that have one or the other or both are all projects that, if they're good projects, can get the maximum points in this section. You don't have to try to combine things.
Next slide.
And then, you know, some environmental benefits from reuse, infrastructure reuse, and sustainable reuse. You'll remember if we've done this in the past, we had this entire sections on sustainability. That was, I think, difficult to address, and I think we've scaled it back here. We've still given you chances to demonstrate how your redevelopment is perhaps more environmentally sensitive than other applicants might be, and take the opportunity to deal with that here. So, you know, I'm through. I think we're getting close to done, and we're going to have questions pretty soon.
Okay. We're just going to go through slide 75 and then into slide 76. We mentioned already, please read the new guidelines, follow the directions. You can check the EPA Brownfield website, or if you know other communities that have gotten grants in the past, you can also potentially get assistance from them. This should be telling a story about your community, and so, you know your community well, so write it as though we know nothing and you're telling us the story about what's going on in your community and why these dollars are needed to assess the brownfields or address the brownfield sites. Matt mentioned if there is a criteria that is not applicable for some reason to your proposal, you need to be clear and state that it is not applicable and explain why. If there's just a blank for a particular criteria or sub-criteria, you probably will get 0 points for that. If you can at least explain why, then you will get points. Use the checklist at the end of the ranking criteria section. Make the proposal as straightforward and simple as possible using a few acronyms. Next slide, 77, just kind of gets into some of the formatting of it. The 18-page limit is an absolute requirement, and that's for the proposal. It does not include the 2-page cover letter. What happens to any additional pages that are above that 18-page limit, they just basically get cut off and no one ever sees them or reviews them. So any information that might be relevant to your project that are on those extra pages, unfortunately, would not be viewed, and you may lose points. Follow the guidelines here for the font and the margins and the lack of color on the pages. Next slide gets into, basically contacting your tribe or state or tribe or EPA early if you have questions on eligibility. Also, if you need to, you need to definitely contact your state to get their support letters. You need to contact them if you're applying for a petroleum contaminated site, if it's a cleanup grant or an assessment site that involves petroleum, so you need to contact them. At the end of our presentation, we do have state contacts included, and so please, contact them early, and they'll let you know what they need in order to make their determinations. Next slide is just another photo, and Mike can probably say a little something about that. This is slide 79. No?
Well, this actually is Consumers Energy Corporate Headquarters in Jackson, Michigan, for which Jackson County used about $75,000 of its assessment grant a number of years ago.
Okay, slide 80 is just the contact information with our regional website. Slide 81 is the, our slides aren't moving, but slide 81 is the list of the state contacts. Slide 82 provides some web resources, the draft guidelines we mentioned. There are some frequently asked questions, fact sheets for the assessment coalitions. Slide 83 provides a link to construction demolition recycling, which I think is worthwhile reading. Again, the regional and the national websites. And then the last slide is just a nice photo of one of our projects. I believe this is up in Minnesota. I wanted to mention that, again, if you want to, you could go to the National Brownfield website, which is listed, the www.epa.gov/brownfields, and then do a backslash and type in listserv, L-I-S-T-S-E-R-V dot H-T-M. And if you don't do it that way, you can always search the National Brownfield website. And if you sign yourself up to on that web site to that listserv, you'll get notification when the guidelines are published, when the RFPs are announced. Okay, at this point, we're going to start with the questions that have come in. And we're going to read through. We have, first question comes from Illinois. What are the guidelines for distribution of the eligible 10% administrative costs among coalition members for a coalition assessment grant?
All right, so if you're applying for a coalition assessment grant, how do you divide up the 10% administrative cost? At the time of application, you're going to need to describe to us, you know, what kind of activities make up that 10%, but you're not going to have to tell us how it's going to be divided up amongst the different coalition members. So you treat it pretty much like you treat any other of the cost factors.
Okay. Next question, also from Illinois, is do we know when the guidelines will be published in the application period? And as we mentioned, we really don't know yet. Could be this month sometime.
I'd look for it end of August, closing end of November.
Okay. Next question from Madison, Wisconsin, is can you explain that the $200 million again? Why only award $75 million if you can award more?
Well, I wish we were awarded more. And what we have is we have a statute that provides for us receiving up to $200 million for our competitive grant program, but we are at the mercy of Congress in terms of how much they appropriate for us. So, and as Dan mentioned earlier, generally we've been appropriated between $70 and $75 million for our competitive grant program.
Okay. Next question is from Illinois. If you're awarded a coalition assessment grant, say for $500,000 for hazardous substance, $500,000 for petroleum, can a coalition reappropriate funds between the two at a later date? In other words, change some of it, change to $600,000 and $400,000 if the needs warrant.
No. We have to give out 25% of these things for petroleum work, and if people start messing around with their allocations after we award things, and we get off of that 25%.
And the headquarters has determined that 25% to be both a floor and a ceiling,
yes.
So it's basically 25%.
All right. Next question is from Elkhart, Indiana. Just to clarify, are meth lab sites eligible for assessment and cleanup under the Hazardous Substance Assessment and Cleanup Grant?
Yes. There's been a practical problem with the cleanup grant use for these sites because there's a requirement that for a cleanup grant, you have to own the site. And nobody wants to own these meth lab sites. Generally, the people that end up cleaning these up, which are often law enforcement agencies, don't own property and don't want to own these. So they're eligible. There's practical problems using the money for that.
All right. Our next question is from Kalamazoo, Michigan. For a coalition proposal, do you need to identify the five or more properties you wish to assess?
And the simple answer is no, and the basis for that is that in the event the coalition receives $1 million, the maximum amount that can be used for assessment at any individual site is $200,000 unless you seek a waiver. So that's why the 5% minimum would apply for $1 million coalition award.
Yeah, and only coalitions can only apply for community-wide projects, and we don't ask to have you identify sites for any community-wide, whether it's a coalition or not.
All right. The next question is from Elyria, Ohio, and it's regarding coalitions. Do the entities need to be contiguous to each other to apply for a coalition proposal?
Nope. You should know each other well enough to be able to work together, but don't have to be contiguous.
No. I mean, I think one thing you would have to consider is looking at it from a management perspective and cross-jurisdictional issues. But never been asked that question before, but the answer is no, as Matt said.
Okay. Our next question is from the Oneida Tribe, and the question is regarding the letter from the tribal authority, environmental authority. If the tribal environmental authority is the instigating factor to apply for the grant, should a letter also be gotten from the tribal environment government body?
I don't think you have to have one. Someone from the governing body, however, is going to have to sign any eventual grant agreement, so it's probably a good thing that they know this application is on its way through, just so there's no surprise. And, you know, oftentimes, not just tribal governing bodies, but local governments, city commissioners, boards of commissioners, have their own requirements that any grant application that's submitted on behalf of the city be approved by the governing board. But that varies place to place.
All right. Next question is regarding ownership, again from Oneida Tribe. Should a fee simple title be submitted with the application if a property is already owned?
Can't hurt. Don't have to do it, but it can't hurt.
Okay. Next question comes from Indianapolis. The draft assessment guidelines list community notification as a threshold criteria. Is this seminar updating the draft guidelines?
Yes.
All right. Our next question is from Gratiot County in Michigan. Please give an example of institutional engineering controls. What does it mean?
Well, a good example of engineering control would be a landfill cap, or oftentimes with respect to cleanup and revolving loan funds, we'll see you've got contaminated soil on site that is going to be left on site and managed, and it can be managed through an engineered barrier such as a parking lot or the footprint of a building. An institutional control might be if you've got groundwater contamination that you've got a deed restriction that precludes the use of installing any wells.
Yeah, another big institutional control is if you're cleaning something up for a commercial or industrial use, there's going to be something on the title that says you can't use that for residential use because it hasn't been cleaned up to a level appropriate for that.
All right, the next question is from Carmel, Indiana. Is there a way to see our score from a previous application that was not approved and how the score broke down? This would be helpful in knowing which areas we specifically may need to improve.
It might be helpful, but we can't tell you what it was. It's part of what we call the deliberative process, which is not subject to Freedom of Information Act.
Okay, next question from Wisconsin in Madison. Does the 18-page limit include attachments?
No.
No, it doesn't. Attachments, you know, we're going to ask you to include these letters of support from your community-based notification partners. That is beyond the page limit. Other letters of support, you know, general letters of support from your congressional representative, your senator, your state senators, you can put them on if it makes you feel better. It doesn't affect the score.
Okay. Next question from Springfield, Illinois. Can a coalition assessment apply for 100% hazardous substance, in other words, a million for hazardous substance and nothing for petroleum?
No. If you're only applying for hazardous, you can only go up to $200,000 per eligible entity per grant type. So if you have three applicants and you only want hazardous waste money, you're only going to be able to ask for $600,000.
Okay.
But if you want some hazardous and some petroleum, but say you don't want all $200,000 per applicant for petroleum, you can't ask for less. So you could have those three entities. You could ask for $600 for hazardous and, you know, $100 or $200 total for petroleum.
Okay. Next question is regarding a cleanup grant. If, and this is from Gratiot County, if a BRA applies for a cleanup grant, does the BRA itself have to own the site, or can the city within the BRA's jurisdiction own the site?
BRA has to own it. The BRA is the eligible entity, not the city. So the BRA is the applicant. The applicant has to own the site.
Okay. And a follow-up question to that is, do we have to apply for the same situation, same scenario? Do we have to apply for the cleanup grant as a coalition with the city?
You can't apply for a cleanup grant as a coalition. Either the BRA or the city has to apply. We just can't. There's no way, there's no facility for us to recognize both as applicants.
Okay. Next question, and we're going to do like three more questions, and then we're going to open it up for some of the people who are participating by phone if there are any other questions. Do the updated grant guidelines apply to existing grants that are already in place? In other words, are they retroactive?
No, they're not retroactive. I don't know if your question is about the eligibility for your assessment sites from your previous community-wide assessment grants. If it is, you use the guidelines from whatever year you got your grant as your eligibility determination when you picked out a grant to work on under your assessment, or picked out a site to work on under your assessment grant.
And as a follow-up, the requirements of your particular grant are going to be dictated by the terms and conditions that are attached to your agreement.
Right.
Okay. One last question is from Columbus, Ohio. I've heard that in the past, letters of support were not looked at during the evaluation process, and that the applicant was scored by the discussion of partnerships and commitments within the text of the grant. Will that be the case again this year, or will letters of support have more weight in the new guidance?
The letters of support are going to have more weight in the new guidance this year because we're asking for them. In the past, we haven't asked for letters of support. We've asked you to describe who it is and what they're going to do. And we've done sort of spot checks where we have a contractor who calls up these community partners and say, you know, are you really doing what this application says you're going to do? We decided instead this year to go ahead and have everybody who's supposed to be a part of it send a support letter. Beyond that, these general support letters like I was talking about won't be reviewed and they're not going to affect your score.
All right. Actually, there is one last question that was just emailed, and the question is, do you anticipate any major changes to the draft guidelines that have been released?
Probably not. I could go into why. It would just take a long time. I don't think they're going to change very much, but do read them closely when they come out.
All right. So at this point, we want to thank everybody for participating, but let you know we have 10 minutes left. So if there's anybody that wants to pose a question via phone, let's maybe go by state. So anyone from Illinois have a question? Okay. Anyone from Michigan?
I'm from Michigan. Could you speak a little bit more to what happens, what the influence of any previous grant administration may have been on future applications? So if you did an assessment grant already, how does that affect or not affect an application for another one or for a different kind of grant this time?
Well, one thing we'll be looking at, and I don't think it's changed from previous years, Matt is actually part of the work group, is looking at the programmatic capability. And if you did manage previous grants, were you timely in submitting quarterly reports? Did you achieve your accomplishments, and so forth? I don't. Matt, is there anything beyond that that was discussed?
No, not really. It'll be wrapped up into this scoring criteria on programmatic capability, like Mike said, people look at your reporting, your timeliness of reporting, you know, how, did the grant close out early with big balances left in the agreement because you didn't complete the work that you proposed to do? Did it take a long time to either get the work started or to get it completed? You know, just how well was that grant managed?
All right. Any questions from...
A common question that we get that's sort of related to that is, can you apply for a grant if you already have one? And the answer is yes. If you have an assessment grant now and you want to apply for one this year, you can do that.
Okay. Any questions from Minnesota participants that are on the phone? How about Ohio participants? How about Indiana participants?
This is Beth Grigsby in Indianapolis. I have a question. It's about the selection, I guess, criteria about factors. And one of the points made in the draft guidelines was that EPA is looking for fair geographic distribution of funds between the 10 regions. Do you think that's going to impact the success that Region 5 has had with past grant allotments?
Probably not.
Good, okay.
I mean, historically, you look at the percentage of proposals that have been submitted by Region 5 as well as other regions across the country, and oftentimes the percentage awarded to that region is consistent with the amount that was requested.
Yeah, generally we do a little bit, I think, better than our share if you broke it down geographically.
One thing that's interesting about Region 5 is the success we've had with the Revolving Loan Fund program, and if you factored in the amount that was requested last fiscal year, including the supplemental awards that are made to existing RLF grantees, close to 50% of the funds requested in Region 5 were for Revolving Loan Fund dollars.
Okay.
Okay, actually we did have one other. Let's ask for Wisconsin, and we had a couple from Wisconsin that we're probably going to respond to by email, but anyone from Wisconsin have a specific question? Okay, well there was one from
I wanted to add one thing real quickly. When I talked about site property and ownership and eligibility issues, in general, among the very large universe of brownfield sites, those that are going to be ineligible are a very small subset. I didn't, for those that have not had any involvement with our program, I didn't want to create the perception that this is going to be a nightmare determining site eligibility. The vast majority of sites will be eligible. Are there sites that are ineligible? Yes. Are there proposals that have failed for that reason? The threshold criteria? Yes. But again, the vast majority are eligible.
I guess we had a couple more web questions if you want to.
Okay. No, we're going to have that.
Okay. Regarding ASTM 1903 equivalency, does the site investigation report need to reference this? Does it get submitted with proposal? So I'm assuming that is in the cleanup section where we say you have to have done a phase one or equivalent. We don't want to see these phase ones. If you have something that's not a phase one that you think is equivalent, tell us what it is. Tell us briefly why you think it's equivalent. If we have any more questions about it, we might call you up and get a copy of it. Another thing about a cleanup grant regarding cost share. Someone wanted to know if cleanup work done at a site prior to the grant award can be used as match. And the answer is no. None of them... No work, no money you've spent at a site prior to the award of the grant can be counted as match.
Okay, and we're going to entertain, I think, one last question about placing an ad. Is this in a newspaper and on the website or one or the other?
It can be one or the other or both. It doesn't have to be both.
Okay. All right, and with this, I think we have to close, and thank you all for participating. Again, you can, well, you will be able to access the audio and the slides from this presentation soon through the CLUIN website, and we plan to keep this on the CLUIN website in their archives at least for the next month. We're anticipating doing another live version of this on September 4th, and at that point we may replace the one that's online with the September 4th presentation. But that is how you'll be able to access this presentation if you or any of your cohorts need to get some information in the interim before the guidelines come out. And again, thank you, Matt and Mike, for doing these presentations. And thank you, everybody, for participating, and we look forward to working with you in the future.